let me in.
Shiba chiba,
I want to be closer to you.
Shiba chiba,
open up your soul.
Shiba chiba,
let me find that part of you, the part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your love.
Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or if it's the first Monday of the month, then we want you to understand something. As you know, I like to have my science envoys here to help you understand things. I had an incredibly abysmal science upbringing, so it's always exciting to have people on the show who try to make an effort to make things explainable and understandable. So here to talk about his favorite branch of science, I'd like to welcome Ari Balaburak. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
So before we get started, tell me, when did you get bitten by the science bug?
That's a good question. In first grade, I had a brilliant teacher.
Okay.
There was one teacher for everything back then.
Yeah.
Her name was Anna, and she loved whales, or she loved teaching about whales. For whatever reason, we learned a lot about whales in first grade, and I was enthralled. I mean, it was awesome to learn about the whales and to kind of be immersed in that world and think about the kinds of questions that we could answer with scientific inquiry. So that was probably the beginning of it.
Wow.
And you know, things kind of progressed from there on out. I was thinking about this, my first ever science interview was when I was 8 years old. I was at a science museum on the day that Pluto was demoted from being a planet.
Oh, I remember that day.
Yeah, right.
And how did you feel about that?
Well, I was bummed. As I said to the interviewer, you know, all my life, all of those 8 years, Pluto had been a planet. It was it was a rock for me. And then it was just another rock floating space. Yeah, exactly. So I feel like there's a good long history there. But yeah, I've been doing science ever since then.
Well, just before we go, when did they explain why Pluto had been demoted? Or was it just like, Pluto's not a planet anymore, it's too bad for you?
You know, they explained. I think it was something to do with clearing its own orbit and, you know, some kind of size minimum. And it, I got it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understood. And certainly worked on the acceptance there. Still probably working on the acceptance there, but it was hard, right? I mean, it was a big deal. We'd been learning about planets in school, and that was a blow. But certainly kind of sparked my interest. I wanted to learn more. You know, why can they just say something's a planet or not?
But it also goes to the heart of science, which is once you reevaluate your information, you have to, you're forced to change your perceptions based on what the evidence is presenting to you.
Absolutely. Exactly. We say, you know, you should never be sure of anything. You can believe something 0.001% or 99.999%, but if there's a strong enough wave of evidence that comes in, we are kind of forced to reevaluate, and exactly like you said.
Okay. So did your love of whales carry you all the way through high school, or did your scientific desire to absorb change over the years?
I still love whales. So certainly that has carried through.
Exactly. Whales?
Right.
Come on.
I mean, yeah. I think the scientific interests did change over time.
Okay.
I had a really phenomenal chemistry teacher in high school. There's kind of a theme here, the power of teachers.
Yeah.
And so I was really into chemistry and assumed that I would be a chemist or at least study chemistry in college. And that remained my thinking until I had a really incredible physics teacher senior year of high school. So at that point, I was really excited about physics. And there's something still very exciting to me about physics, that it's kind of the most basic unit of analysis aside from maybe pure math. But there are these physical laws, and that is the way the universe works, and everything else, the complexity of chemistry, the immense complexity of biology, love, emotions, you know, all kind of is able to emerge from that foundation.
Okay, so you have these amazing teachers throughout your elementary and high school years. You get to college. Does another teacher like put you on a different scientific path?
A little bit. So I did study physics in college. I was a physics major. But I had gone into college thinking, I will not be a computer scientist. I will not be a computer scientist. I don't want to spend my life sitting in front of computers.
Famous last words.
Famous last words. And I took a computer science class the spring semester of my freshman year. So I kind of still feel like I was late to the party because I didn't do it from the very beginning. And it was a cool way to solve problems. I mean, the way I talk about computers is they're extremely stupid, which is getting harder and harder to believe these days, I think, but they're really fast.
Okay.
So all of the power is yours in giving the right instructions to this stupid and fast machine.
Mm.
And if you can do something really simple 4 billion times a second, you can do some pretty incredible things. So I became interested in computer science, but maybe even more so the power of computation, which has really carried through to where I am now. I am kind of no longer a computer scientist, so my pre-college self would be proud, although I do still spend a lot of time in front of computers.
Okay.
And what I'm doing now is much more kind of leveraging that power of computation to address more applied real-world challenges, which I'd be happy to chat more about.
Yeah, let's talk about that. But before we do, I just want to, because you talk about computers being stupid but fast. And I remember we had an exercise when I was in junior high where you had to write instructions on how to do something very simple and give it to someone. But it had to be so detailed that if you left out anything, like any common sense thing, it would fail. And computers are like that, where if you leave out even the most common sense thing, and because it's all zeros and ones, so how were you able to wrap your brain around how granular did you have to get before you were like, nope, I'm out?
Yeah, I love that. And I remember that exercise as well. It's brilliant and I think really kind of educational, valuable for kids to be exposed to that, like really having to give comprehensive instructions.
Right.
Computers are interesting because so much of it is standing on the shoulders of giants. I mean, we learned in that undergrad computer science major about machine code and some of the ones and zeros, but you also learn the way things have been built on top of that so that you can get a very low-level programming language, and then you can get much higher-level programming languages that make calls to that lower-level programming language, but you don't have to deal with them, and they look much more like human-readable text. And then you get applications, which are kind of a layer on top of that, where you can click something with your mouse. And now we're seeing, you know, a layer on top of that. You can just say something and there are ones and zeros producing that answer for you, but it sure doesn't feel that way.
Okay. Okay.
So yeah, lots of different ways to use computers. And I think we are really seeing an explosion of that right now. But I do love the idea that these machines can only do what we instruct them to do.
Sure. And I think a lot of people forget that. It's like, you know, garbage in, garbage out, or, you know.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you said that, because a whole lot of computation is garbage in, garbage out. So it's important to keep that in mind.
So you talk about you veered off into your own world. And what world is that?
That is the world of climate change policy research.
Ooh, okay.
So after undergrad, I did a 1-year master's in computer science in England, and during that year decided that I was more interested in the applications than in the development of computation.
Okay.
The thinking basically was, right, and I'm glad that computer scientists are still out there, you know, making these machines even more miraculous, but my feeling was, for me personally, I'll feel more fulfilled taking these machines, which are pretty darn miraculous at this point, and applying them.
So how do you apply them to climate change?
So right now I'm doing a bunch of research in a few different areas, but all focused on informing more effective and equitable climate change mitigation policy. So to break some of that down, climate change mitigation is the side of kind of dealing with climate change that is actually reducing the greenhouse gas emissions.
Mm-hmm.
You'll hear about mitigation on the one hand and adaptation on the other hand.
Okay.
We have to both take the problem away by mm-hmm. reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, which cause climate change, and at the same time figure out how we're going to live with the climate change that we have caused. So I'm more on that first side,
okay.
where I'm kind of in the business of figuring out how we can reduce our emissions to zero.
Okay.
And I believe that there's a strong role for public policy there. I don't think our economic systems are going to do them on their own. I don't think individuals are able within those systems to mm-hmm. fully make decisions to do this on their own, right?
Mm-hmm.
I do think we need policy support. And so my job is creating tools and creating insights that allow policymakers to be a little bit more strategic so that their policy mm. is more effective in its kind of ability to make this mitigation come about, and also more equitable so that the impacts of that climate change mitigation reduce rather than exacerbate existing inequalities.
And that's interesting because science and public policy, like a lot of times, like science is somewhat theoretical in nature, and public policy is very much it can be subject to the whims of whatever politician is in office, and it seems like climate change is unnecessarily politicized.
Absolutely.
And how do you, as a scientist, how do you deal with the fact that you're not dealing with people who are using empirical data, but people who are maybe looking out for their own self-interest?
Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of kind of different dimensions to that. It's tricky. So,
sure.
I mean, the first one is just acknowledging that it's super tricky. We mm-hmm. can produce all of the information possible mm-hmm. and really get a good handle on this problem, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the policy will be implemented
mm-hmm.
because, like you said, politics rule the world, or at least this country at the moment. That said, I think there are kind of subsets of the science that can really help us out there.
Okay.
So some of my research focuses on behavioral and psychological aspects of this problem,
okay.
where the goal isn't to change anyone's mind, and the goal isn't to, you know, set up some draconian system where people are being told what to do, but the goal is to figure out why aren't people embracing some of these lower carbon technologies, and what's going on at the systems level, what's going on in their individual lives that could
okay.
present barriers, and how can we identify win-wins where we're setting things up in a way that is better for these people
mm-hmm.
and better for the kind of entire Earth at large, because we're dealing with less climate change. And I do feel some optimism that some of those insights could be adopted into policy. Because the other side of that is part of the way I see my science
mm-hmm.
is the communication aspect.
Mm-hmm.
And not only communicating my findings, but really working to inform the science that I do with societal needs. So I'm aware that we're in a challenging political situation right now, and that's
mm-hmm.
why I think sometimes changing the messaging around this can be really important, and embracing a kind of empirically grounded optimism
mm-hmm.
Can be a really important antidote to like you said, the unnecessary politicization of this issue.
Now, do other scientists have a difficulty in reconciling the need to be able to communicate with their pure scientific approach?
Absolutely. I think there are scientists who very reasonably kind of feel and believe that the purest science cannot be leveraged into advocacy or even necessarily communication, because communicating it would necessarily water it down. And I think that's legitimate
mm-hmm.
in many fields and in many circumstances. If my science is done in the service of affecting policy change,
mm-hmm.
then the communication is not something that dilutes it, but is quite the contrary. It is a necessary part
right.
of my science.
It's a key component to
exactly.
it. So let's get away from the public policy facing portion of it. And let's talk about the actual research itself. So what does it look like and what are some of your findings?
Absolutely. So a lot of my research focuses on the idea of positive tipping points. And
okay.
when I say positive tipping points, these are kind of socioeconomic and technological tipping points
mm-hmm.
where the idea is if you create the right enabling conditions. So if you set up a system to be kind of particularly conducive to these tipping points,
mm-hmm.
and then you give it a little bit of a push, whether that's some kind of public procurement or a subsidy or a little bit of a carbon tax, and you know, regulate a sector just so,
mm-hmm.
then you can kick off this positive tipping point where different institutions and technologies and cultural features develop together in such a way that virtuous cycles emerge. You get
mm-hmm.
reinforcing positive feedback loops, and all of a sudden this gargantuan task of, let's say, reducing transport emissions goes from something that feels very scary to something that feels inevitable. And you get these self-reinforcing feedbacks that lead to kind of cheaper, more equitable, more accelerated decarbonization or emissions reductions than
uh-huh.
you would have had otherwise.
So does that mean that you are looking at the world and seeing what different people are doing in the real world, or playing out scenarios? I mean, how are you forming these ideas?
Yeah, a lot of it is scenario modeling. So that's where some
of
the computation comes in, because you say if we have this kind of model of change
mm-hmm.
and we can simulate it using computation to you know, let's say play out the transport sector to 2050, what happens in a business as usual case, which we can get back to. I think business as usual is a tricky word.
Okay.
And what happens if we have this policy intervention? Now what happens if we assume this rate of technological development? So we're kind of tinkering with our made-up representation of the world that we
mm-hmm.
have reason to believe is valuable and useful, and then seeing what happens with that in different policy scenarios and in different social scenarios.
So if you are using, I'll use your words, the made-up scenarios, how are they based on? Are they based on models that you've actually seen in real life, or are they purely theoretical?
It's a bit of both. So they have a theoretical underpinning
uh-huh.
In the sense that, let's say, you assume that technologies experience cost declines with every additional unit of production. So when you double the cumulative capacity of solar panels,
mm-hmm.
the costs fall by X percent.
And where do you get that assumption?
Well, that plays out with technologies across the board.
Oh, okay. And so that's a real world.
Pretty true across the board. And
okay.
then we kind of calibrate the model so that the numbers that it uses are based on what's happened with solar panels historically.
Okay.
Solar panels, I mean, it's been an incredible success story. I think costs have declined something like 10 times in the last decade or two.
Oh,
so we've
nice.
Really seen the costs come down. And the same is true for wind. The same is true for battery storage. The same
uh-huh.
is true for hydrogen electrolyzers. There are a lot of really exciting technological developments. So it's a theoretical component of the model, but the numbers are very much grounded in what we're seeing in the real world and what's been going on for the last few decades.
Okay, so then with the real world historical data that you're using, are there any real world sort of human behavior models that you are using to also make this simulation more accurate?
Yeah, we're working on those,
is oh, okay.
what I would say. Different parts of the puzzle are more and less easy to, you know, tell a computer, give a computer instructions to run.
Mm-hmm.
Humans are notoriously complex.
Messy.
Right, but it is crucial that we understand that messiness, because
okay.
at the end of the day, it is human behavior, among many other things, that needs to change somewhat.
So are there any historical models of human behavior that have been vetted as relatively reliable, or is it still kind of the Wild West out there in terms of trying to figure it out?
I'd say it's pretty context dependent.
For example?
There are models of kind of what drives human decisions to invest in solar panels for their home, or models of what factors influence the decision to buy an electric vehicle rather than a gas-powered vehicle. Mm-hmm. But we certainly don't have a kind of here's how human beings work and here are the inputs. And the question is, how much should we, how much can we generalize from the solar panels to a completely different model? Are there factors that are important across the board? You know, 10 years ago, even today, to some extent, these models were dominated by kind of rational economic choice. So you hear about this sometimes where it's everybody is a perfectly rational consumer who compares the price of good A with the price of good B. Mm-hmm. And never mind that good B might not be available in their city, or there might not be trained technicians available, or they might be put on a 3-month waiting list, but you need heat in your home tonight because it's cold outside. And a lot of these issues are kind of intimately intertwined with some of these justice and equity considerations that I was speaking about a little earlier. So it's challenging to create those behavioral models, but I do think it's important, and we're working on it.
Well, I love the fact that people recognize that those rational economic models just don't hold any water, because people aren't perfect rational creatures any more than a computer is a genius. It's like people just sort of make things up on the fly and then kind of justify it after the fact. But let's pivot to your actual research. How long have you been doing it, and what are some of the things that have emerged while you've been doing the research, some things that you've discovered or things that surprised you?
Yeah, so I've been in this field now for about 4 years.
Okay.
It was 4 years ago that I kind of finished the computer science master's and moved toward environmental policy. The first year of that was kind of a one-year master's, so I was doing some research, but then the research really kicked into overdrive at the end of that year. So it's now been 3 years, two doing research as part of a kind of research institute at a university, and one now just at the beginning of my PhD.
Okay.
So part of the research was focusing on different sectors where we're starting to see some of these tipping points and evidence of tipping points that are either underway or very close or possible. You know, it's possible that we could see a tipping point there. One of those was the electricity generation sector, where I think we've kind of already hit our tipping point. And it's going to be, you know, slow at times, frustratingly slow at times. There are lots of considerations about kind of how does this transition work in practice. But at this point, solar energy is the cheapest energy in history, and energy storage technologies are drastically becoming cheaper. So the kind of bottom line here is that renewable energy, right, energy from the sun, the wind, water, is rapidly becoming the cheapest energy available and the energy that makes the most sense for us to consume. And there aren't greenhouse gases associated with that. So it's really exciting news there.
So when you say we hit a tipping point, you're saying in the real world there's been a tipping point. And what was the tipping point that made people like that makes it seem like an inevitability that it'll be solar power and wind power and all of these things?
Yeah, so I think the tipping point there, and it's ironic that we just spent a little bit of time bashing that good old rational economic choice assumption, but the tipping point there was largely economic. And that has to do with the way that the energy sector is, or the electricity sector is set up, right? We pay electricity bills, but we're not generating the electricity ourselves. That happens at the utility, and it's kind of very central control. They make these decisions on the basis of cost, roughly speaking, and they have the time, they have the power, they have the resources to make these kind of long-term forecasts and cost-benefit analysis, and they've decided that looking forward, solar and wind and batteries and hydrogen and hydroelectric make a lot of sense. So that's why we're seeing utilities rapidly shifting toward renewables. There's still some natural gas generation because natural gas is kind of historically cheap right now. But we're certainly shifting away from coal-fired electricity, certainly shifting away from oil for electricity, at least in this country, which is just far more expensive, and toward those lower-cost renewables. the picture looks very different in a sector like transport, where the decision making happens at an individual level, right? Whether I'm going to walk to work today or bike or buy a car or take public transport. There are still some structural decisions, right? Mm-hmm. Our communities are not laid out very well for walking and biking. We don't necessarily have very good public transport options for a lot of people. And then even if you're going to decide to buy an automobile or use an automobile, rent an automobile, there's the question of what type, right? Is it going to have an electric engine? Is it going to be a hybrid, gas, et cetera? So it's a little more complicated when you have the decision makers kind of at a much more distributed level, at the individual level. But I believe we're actually pretty close to a tipping point in the transport sector as well. And that's largely down to the rapid cost declines in electric vehicles. I mean, there's an electric vehicle that's available now in China for $11,000 new. I think a lot of Americans are go kind of like, oh, wow, I wish. And that those costs are just going to continue to decline. Young people are moving slowly but surely away from the kind of personal vehicle model. Our cities are becoming a little bit more walkable. I know San Francisco just opened a huge kind of housing complex that does not have parking. It's seen as kind of a radical first there. And so that tipping point is not just economic. It's not just technological, but it has social and cultural dimensions as people are moving away from the personal automobile paradigm. And certainly shared mobility is playing a role. Things like scooters and e-bikes and city bike shares for that last mile problem for people who do use public transport. We're also seeing some really cool kind of coordination effects. That's another mechanism for these tipping points, where the example I like to use is electric vehicles and the EV charging network. It's more profitable to build chargers the more vehicles there are on the road, because you can kind of count on higher utilization. But the more chargers there are on the road, the more likely I am to buy an electric vehicle, because I don't have to worry about range anxiety. So you get kind of another virtuous cycle there, where it's a little chicken and egg, like who's going to take the leap of faith. But once there are EVs on the road, we can expect to see more chargers. And once there are more chargers, we can expect to see more EV adoption.
Now, you talk about the decision-making being sort of diffuse in terms of transportation, but isn't the decision-making about that, isn't it really still more about public policy? Because in places where there is robust public transportation, you have a much lower, like I was in Amsterdam, and it's impossible to drive in Amsterdam, but you're on your bike or you're in a on one of the trams, and it's fantastic and it's reliable and you can get where you need to go. But then you go to another city, like you go to LA, and it's spread out, the public transportation, maybe it'll show up, maybe it won't, if they have anything at all. And it seems like if people could do without cars, they would, unless, you know, there was some compelling reason, like, you know, a disability or something like that.
Absolutely. So that's a fantastic distinction and great listening there. I was kind of conflating the decision making. There's the kind of technology adoption or behavioral change decision making. And then there's the decision making of, what are we going to do about this? How do we get to net zero? How do we decarbonize our economy, reduce greenhouse gas emissions? And I personally, as a kind of systems thinker and a public policy buff, would pretty much always put the onus on kind of public policy decision makers to nudge the system in the right direction. So when I say the decision making is more diffuse for the transport sector, it means that the day-to-day decision about, am I going to drive to work today or take public transport? Am I going to purchase a new vehicle to replace our car that just broke down? That happens at the individual level. But the decision to do anything about it, the decision to change the system and to, you know, create public procurement models for electric vehicles to keep bringing those costs down, to build new public transport lines, to protect bike lanes. I do think there's a huge role for that in the public sector, kind of from the top down. And of course, a role for active citizens to advocate for that from the bottom up.
Okay. Now I want to talk about, let's say I was observing you for the day as you go through your job. What am I going to see when you're doing it? Are you sitting at a computer typing in numbers? Or what is it that you're doing? Or if there was a kid following you around, what would they notice that you do every day?
Yep. So with the PhD, I've been a little all over the place, and I'm kind of celebrating that diversity of experience. Mm-hmm. Right now, I kind of have three jobs. So I'd say the time is split fairly evenly between those, plus that kind of additional bucket of PhD activities, which I'll get to at the end.
Okay.
So the three jobs right now, they're very nice. They kind of fit into three levels of analysis. I like to think about systems at all of their different scales.
All right.
So one job is about equity in the transition to electric vehicles.
Okay.
So it's this big project happening at UC Berkeley Law School's Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment. And lots of people on the project are looking at the very different kind of diverse dimensions of justice and equity in the transition to electric vehicles. So people mm-hmm. are thinking about governance models and ownership models for charging infrastructure, and how are we rolling out and pricing new electric vehicle models to have kind of an eye toward equity. Mm-hmm. The part that I am working on is a mapping tool which helps local governments make decision about where to put EV chargers. So it's a kind of site selection decision support, and we're bringing together a bunch of data on first of all, where are the people? But not only where are the people, where are multifamily housing residents and where are renters? Those are groups who face higher barriers to charging at home and might rely on public charging infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And then which communities have experienced a particularly high environmental burden or experience high levels of pollution, so would benefit the most from a transition toward cleaner mobility? Where are lower income communities? Where are communities who could benefit from federal and state funding for electric vehicle charging infrastructure, which does exist out there but can be really hard to navigate and find? And so we put all this data together. You can then overlay community resources, so things like public schools and healthcare facilities and public transport options, and it can really streamline both the process of choosing a site for your kind of new publicly funded electric vehicle charger,
mm-hmm.
But can also be a really powerful communication tool. So you can bring the nice, pretty maps that you made with our tool to stakeholder engagement meetings and say, look, we wanted this community and this community to have access to this charger. We've put it close to a healthcare facility, and it'll be close to this commercial area. And then also for your grant applications, you can write to the federal government and say, we used this tool, which is kind of publicly available, open mm-hmm. source, mm-hmm. and we've determined that this is the best location for this, 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 and this reason. And you can really streamline the permitting process in that way, which has historically been a barrier to deployment of these chargers.
Okay, so that's one.
So that's one job.
Okay.
The second job is kind of moving up a level of analysis, and that's looking at energy system models for the U.S. as a whole,
mm-hmm.
and particularly, we kind of touched on this, the way that they represent behavioral realism, so the way that they represent human decision-making. So we looked at three technologies, rooftop solar panels, electric vehicles, and electric heat pumps for home heating, and kind of looked through the literature at what actually matters for decision making around these technologies,
mm-hmm.
who is buying them, and what are they kind of thinking about as they're choosing whether or not to adopt these low carbon technologies.
Mm-hmm.
And then we looked at the models that are used to inform climate policy in the US, and we said, okay, how well are these models actually capturing the important variables? Because again, so many of them are focused on rational economic choice, but for a heat pump, it really matters the local climate that you live in,
mm-hmm.
because that very directly determines the efficiency of your heat pump. Whereas gas furnaces have pretty much the same efficiency regardless of local climate. The insulation in your home, whether it's a new home or a mm-hmm. retrofit, really matters.
Mm-hmm.
If you have ductless heating, it's very hard to transition to a heat pump. For electric vehicles, the presence of charging infrastructure mm-hmm. really matters. Electricity prices are crucial for all of these because they are home electrification, which also decreases greenhouse gas emissions. But if electricity is really expensive, as it is today,
mm-hmm.
that can be a huge barrier.
Okay.
So it's that kind of audit of the models that are being used right now to inform decision making based in the literature of what actually matters to consumers. And then the third project is looking at a global scale, kind of taking a step back and saying, what are the types of tools that policymakers have at their disposal?
Okay.
And how do these tools work, but also work together, given, you know, a model that we think is a little bit more accurate in its representation of how systems change. So what we're looking at in particular is the efficacy of a carbon price, which is where you say you have to pay however many dollars to emit 1 ton of carbon dioxide, or the equivalent. And that has been kind of the favorite policy instrument for economists in particular, because it kind of perfectly internalizes the cost of greenhouse gas emissions. If I emit a ton of carbon dioxide, it's bad for the entire world. And if I don't pay that price, that kind of social price, then we have a mismatch and it's a market failure, and and, you know, everyone's unhappy. So economists love the tool of the carbon price. And we're saying carbon price is probably a necessary condition when it comes to your climate policy instruments, but it's probably not sufficient. And people have been saying this for a while. This isn't groundbreaking, but using this kind of more advanced model, we're showing essentially when you regulate this sector, when you say, you know what, we can move on from coal, no more coal-fired power plants can be built starting next year, 2025. Here's the emissions reductions that come from that. Here's how they compare to a carbon price. And here's how you can get, essentially achieve emissions reductions that would have been kind of impossible under any market policy by combining policy instruments together.
Okay, that is a lot. But I actually understood it. That made me really happy.
Excellent. That makes me happy to hear.
So we're, gosh, I want to talk more to you, but we can't. So if people want to find out more about your research and about what's happening in climate change, what do you recommend they do? Do they go to, do they find out, do they contact where you're doing your research, or how do they do it?
There are a lot of really incredible resources out there, and I think the kind of climate science and climate policy research communities have been pretty amazing at that communication arm. So a ton of incredible resources out there. I'm blanking on kind of specific names, but I know Kimberly Nicholas is an incredible climate educator. She actually spoke at our department recently, and she has compiled a remarkable amount of resources at kind of each step of the climate education pipeline. So she has this great kind of six-pronged approach. I hope I get it right, but it's climate, it's warming, we're sure, it's us, it's bad, and we can fix it. And each of those is itself kind of an area of research and an area to learn more about. I think of myself as kind of having the privilege of working in that last one, we can fix it. So I have the happiest job of those six. But she's compiled a whole bunch of really interesting literature there.
And what's your research lab?
My research lab is the Energy and Resources Group at UC Berkeley. That's my department. And the lab that I'm part of in particular is called RAIL, which is the Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory.
Okay. And then how did you find out about Wonderfest?
Oh, wow. My supervisor, my kind of PhD advisor, put me in touch. He has been a speaker at Wonderfest events for a while and kind of put me in touch with Tucker. And it's pretty perfectly aligned with the kind of stuff that I do. You know, I'm all about getting this kind of thinking out of the lab and into the world. So it felt very fortunate to have this ability and the ability all of this year to be a science communicator with Wonderfest.
Well, Ari, it's been... I really wish I could talk more with you because this is fascinating. If people want to find out more about your research, how would they go about doing that?
Yeah, you can find me on the Energy and Resources Group website. I have a few academic publications out there and hopefully some more coming soon. And in general, the Energy and Resources Group and RAIL, Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory, put out a lot of cool research. So you can see what I'm doing, what my incredible cohort of students is doing. There's some really exciting stuff going on there. So I definitely recommend heading over to those websites.
Well, Ari Balburak, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much, GG Marilyn.
People of Earth, science doesn't have to be hard. Sometimes people are just really good at explaining things, and then you understand it. If you didn't have the type of science education that you would have liked, just know it's not all scary. It can be understood. And what else can be understood is the theater that's going on in the world today. So in just a little bit, we'll be talking with the Wii Players about some fun stuff that you can do. So stay tuned, all right? All right. Saunders King and Swingin' All Day. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Now, you know I love me some Wii Players, and we are fortunate they're back and better than ever. I'd like to welcome the fabulous and talented Ava Roy. Welcome.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on the show today. So for our listening audience who doesn't know about the Wii Players, give us a little bit of your, give us the 411.
The spiel, yeah. All right. Well, my friends out there in the listening world, Wii Players presents site-specific performances in our state, national, and municipal parks. So when you are an audience member for a Wii Players show, you're on your feet, you're following the actors, dancers, musicians through the world of the play, you're on your feet, moving. In the case of this spring, right now, we're presenting an adaptation of Alice in Wonderland called Adventures with Alice in beautiful Golden Gate Park. And you walk about a mile over the course of the production. And you're outside listening to the birds and feeling the wind and the sun on your skin while also engaging in some really magical, joyful, silly, fun art with some brilliant performers.
Now, this is not your first time putting on the Alice in Wonderland, is it?
It's true. We are back this year, backed by popular... Sold out right away last year. It's such a fun show. So many people have such personal relationships with Wonderland and Looking mm-hmm. Glass and all the characters. And we kind of sold out a little too quickly here to reach as many people as we'd like to. And so we are presenting it again this year. It's very similar, but there are some new tricks up our sleeve. We have a couple of new actors, a new character, and a new scene. See it last year. I really encourage you to come back and see it again and meet some of the new characters. And if you haven't seen it, I really hope that you'll consider coming out and joining us. It's fun for all ages. We say the show is appropriate for ages 5 to 95. Mm-hmm. So as long as you're feeling comfortable kind of walking, it's not a very rigorous walk, but it is a walk. And it's just such a special part of Golden Gate Park. It's kind of a somewhat hidden in plain view stretch. I think people are a little less familiar with the particular route that we go on, though people will most likely be familiar with the place where we end up, which is at Lloyd Lake at the intersection of JFK and Transverse. And little people are welcome, as are kids of all ages.
All right, so I just want to say we're having a little bit of problem with your audio, so... just a tiny bit, every once in a while. But I think that we haven't missed anything key. So you talk about being in the public park, being in Golden Gate Park, and there's a lot of walking around. So what should the person who's thinking about attending this show, what should they keep in mind, especially if they're bringing kids?
great questions, because all of us, kids of all ages, really need to wear closed-toed shoes that we are comfortable walking on uneven terrain. As I said, it's not particularly rigorous or steep, but it is on your feet the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be very beautiful, but it can also have the fog and the wind roll in the late afternoon, right before sunset. So we really encourage people to bring lots of warm layers. As we know, living in our beautiful Bay Area, there are many microclimates, and it might be summer in the Mission and winter in the western part of the park. So we encourage people to bring warm layers for the 2.5 hour experience, because when the fog rolls in, it does get chilly.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, just bring a willingness to play and be engaged with the world of Alice in Wonderland. There are opportunities for audience members to participate directly with the actors. That is by choice, of course.
Mm-hmm.
The most basic level of participation is physically moving, but then there are other levels that people can choose as they go along. And the other would just be open eyes and senses to be curious about what's happening in the greater sphere of performance. There are red-tailed hawks and great-horned owls that sometimes pay us visits, and many other songbirds, and filtered light through the Monterey cypress trees. So we encourage people to really explore with all of their senses, open as well as watching and following the story as it unfolds.
Now talk about the starting point, because I know for me, because I get lost easily, I mean very easily, I like how do people know where to go and where to start?
Well, it's very helpful because you go to weplayers.org, first of all, which is where tickets can be made, reservations can be made. And when you make a reservation, you get a whole how to prepare email from WePlayers that explains where to be, when to be there, what snacks to bring, what your seating options will be. We do present some options for people who want to have seating. They just have to carry their little folding stool with them. So the starting point is near the stables. Historic stables, which is near the polo field, which is near the bison paddock over in that western end of the park off JFK. But when someone makes a reservation through weplayers.org, they will receive a robust how to prepare email to prepare them for the experience.
Okay, okay. Now, what are some of the other productions that you've done in the past, and what can we look forward to in the future?
Thank you. Yeah, well, as I said, you know, our work, we really specialize in doing site-specific performances in our local parks. So we've done everything from productions on the islands in the bay. We did Hamlet on Alcatraz, which is a national park site, a number of years ago. We did an island-wide production of The Odyssey on Angel Island State Park, which is a California state park. We've been at Sutro Baths. We have been in various parts of Golden Gate Park at the Music Concourse, at the Palace of Fine Arts. And this stretch of Golden Gate Park that Alice is in is a real favorite because it really has that magical feeling of being in the forest while being very much still just right in the heart of San Francisco. And we're also really excited about some partnerships we've been developing with other companies through the Bay Area, with other theater companies, particularly California Shakespeare Theater, which is in Orinda in the East Bay. And they're actually celebrating their 50th anniversary this year. And we will be bringing our two-woman show called Mother Lear, which is an adaptation of King Lear, although it's only an hour long, and it tells a story about a mother and daughter, and she is an aging Shakespeare scholar with dementia, and the only language she has left is the text of King Lear. And I actually play the caretaker daughter. So that piece is really special. We've been doing it for a number of years. We recently made a film version of it that is available for folks to check out and rent. People can find the links to that on our website, weplayers.org.
Very cool.
But we are also presenting the live version of that play this September at California Shakespeare Theater as part of their 50th anniversary. And it's also really exciting for me personally because during our time at Cal Shakes this September, we're going to be presenting a piece that's really brand new for me. It's kind of a hybrid between a visual art installation and a performance art installation. So folks who go to Cal Shakes either to see Mother Lear by We Players or to see their main stage show, which this summer will be As You, or this fall will be As You Like It, people will have the opportunity to experience this this installation sculpture that I am making and will be presenting on site. And on select days, there will be a moon goddess present at the top of this 12-foot temple who will have intimate performances with audience members as they interact with the sculpture and as they arrive on campus. So, and then actually in 2 weeks, we are taking half of the Alice cast over to New York City because the New York Botanical Garden, which is in the Bronx, 250-acre botanical garden, amazing space. They are actually having a five-month-long exhibit called Wonderland Curious Nature. So if you're listening and you have friends or family in New York, or you just happen to be planning a trip there this spring or summer, check out their garden-wide exhibits, which feature garden exhibits, art installations, and the big opening weekend celebration, which is May 18th and 19th, will include Wii players via the Red Queen, the White Rabbit, Alice herself, and the mischievous Tweedledum and Tweedledee Wonder Twins of Trouble will be causing all sorts of creative mischief all over the garden that weekend. So we've got a lot going on right now, and then in New York in a couple of weeks, and then back home in California over at our dear friends, California Shakespeare Theater in Orinda in September.
Wow, that's a huge amount of stuff that's going on. Question:
plenty happening.
Is there any play that's sort of on your, you know, I'm gonna do this. We're gonna do this before we die. Like it's you really want to do it, but you haven't had the opportunity or the venue yet. Or is there a venue like, I want to be there before we die?
Oh, my gosh. I have so many answers to all of those questions and more questions to add to those questions. But one thing I'll say that jumps to mind immediately is that, so I mentioned Mother Lear, that piece, you know, is a brand new work. It's a co-creation by my collaborator, Courtney Walsh, and I. And it really, for me, was a catalyst for making additional works in that same vein, where it uses Shakespearean language and text and story as the starting point, source point for creating new work. So I've actually written a new piece called Sycorax, which is a character that we never meet in The Tempest. If audience members are familiar with The Tempest, or even if you're not, check it out. There's a lot of really cool interpretations of The Tempest. It's one of Shakespeare's last plays, arguably his last full-length play that he wrote. And it's full of magic and wonder, and it takes place on an island. And there's a character who's a female character, a witch named Sycorax, who is talked about, but we never meet in the play. And I got really curious about her, so I've invented a whole new prequel to The Tempest called Sycorax that we will be developing and premiering next year in 2025.
Oh, cool.
So that's the piece that I think, you know, doesn't exist yet, but will exist in my mind. And I've started to do some development work with a prop designer, costume designer, and actors who will be in it. So I'm really hungry and excited to work on that piece in particular. And another part about that that's quite new for us is, as I've described, so much of our work is built for one location, is non-transferable, and I've been building a series of shows that have a bit more mobility and are able to be flexible to diverse spaces. So that's kind of a new frontier for me personally, is building something that can be integrated into each site it's performed in and have it have the potential to go to multiple sites, unlike some of these shows like Hamlet on Alcatraz, which is really exclusively for Alcatraz,
etc.
So, yeah, I think I'm excited. I'm always excited about the next project. You know what the next thing is going to be? But in the meantime, I am also still just delighted every time I go to Golden Gate Park to see Wonderland. You know, I've seen it many, many times now, having both directed it and produced it last year and again this year. And yet every time there's just some little quirk or moment of improvisation that one of the actors does that just delights me and thrills me and makes me feel like it's a new play, which I think is a real treat to see and experience the same thing in new ways over and over again because of interpretation and environment and the fact that we're always changing and listening with new ears and seeing with new eyes.
Well, we have less than 30 seconds left. So for our listening audience, when and where and the name and the times and where to get tickets.
Yes, indeed. We players, two words. We, like you and me, players, like having a good time. weplayers.org. We're in Golden Gate Park now through June 2nd with Adventures with Alice. Tickets and details are available on the website. And if you're going for a run or a walk or a bike ride along JFK, you'll see a bunch of light post banners with a really fun cartoon rabbit, and you know you're in the right place. That signifies you are on the edges of Wonderland. So check out weplayers.org, that information, and in a couple of weeks we'll have information up there about how to get tickets for the projects in September that I mentioned as well.
All right. Well, Ava Roy, it's always a delight and a pleasure to have you on the show.
Same. Thank you so much for having me. Great to chat with you.
No problem. Okay, people of Earth, so much fun stuff to do. I barely scratched the surface of all the wonderful things there are to do in and around the city. So if you're not doing stuff, it's because you're choosing not to, because we went through a pandemic where nobody could do anything. Now we can do tons of stuff. Go out and do it. I'm going to leave you with Jesse Rose and Touch My Horn. Mr. Ford will be here pretty soon. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta. And toodle-doo.